Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming back to World Forge. World Forge is a podcast by creators and for creators, where we use random prompts to invent just about anything you can imagine. Together, we'll make heroes and villains, ancient monsters and magical cities, and our hope is that we can inspire all the other creators and storytellers out there listening to do the same. So without any further ado, I'm Piper.
And I'm Sam.
And welcome to World Forge. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to World Forge.
Welcome back to World Forge. Welcome back to what's probably going to be kind of a packed episode here, I think.
Oh, yeah. We've got a topic that I'm certainly very passionate about, and I believe you are as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've also got some house cleaning. We've got a few other things to kind of talk about leading up to it. We're going to be touching on some of our experiences using our starter adventure that we developed last week. We were able to use that in a session, which was really exciting. And of course, we'll be doing our own little creations as we do every week here. So there's a lot to get to this time around, and I'm really excited about a lot of it. I think this is going to be a fun episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, should we introduce the topic first, or should we talk about our session from last week?
Let's save it for a mystery.
Okay.
The listeners definitely don't read the titles of the episodes.
Get to wait with bated breath for the anticipation.
I am actually quite excited to talk about how our session went. So for anyone who, you know, forgot what we talked about last week.
Or didn't hear it.
We created a starter session for some friends of ours that had never played D&D before. And so we wanted to try and make kind of a balanced sort of game where we could do some role play, we could do some combat, we could kind of show them how the skill system works, we'd roll a couple dice, all that sort of fun stuff. And we workshopped that on air, and we thought it would be especially fun if the setting we kind of decided on, which was, I think, your brilliant stroke of genius was to have the party participate in a wedding, basically. And how we ended up doing that was they were passing through town and there was a wedding that was happening, and there had been some strange occurrences, maybe some threats made towards the wedding party, and the alderman of the town asked these travelers coming through if they would be willing to stay on a couple days and, you know, help kind of safeguard the wedding, make sure everything went off without a hitch. And your character was actually the officiant at the wedding, so that was kind of a fun way to combine everybody as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I thought that was neat. I would, I guess, want to hear maybe your perspective on how it went, because I ended up being the person running it, and I did do some pretty significant tweaks, I think, from what we had talked about on air, just because I wanted as much of it as possible to be kind of a surprise for you, too.
Yeah.
So that was something that was a big focus for me, was to kind of keep the heart of what we discussed last week, but to still put a few new little twists in there. Do you think that was kind of effective, or what was the experience like for you?
No, I thought it was good. So what we had decided on air is that we had worked out who, like, the villain was going to be, essentially. That it was the bride had this, like, ex-fiancé who didn't want the wedding to happen, and he was the one threatening things. And so that was, like, the information that I had from our session, or from our recording. And then we went in to, like, actually, you know, do the game. And Sam, ahead of time, had given me, like, a piece of paper that had, like, four different names on it of different people that I would have encountered in this month of being there prior. So when we got this kind of ominous, threatening note that was, like, shot through the window on, like, a little arrow.
Yeah, which I literally wrote a note and wrapped it around an arrow and gave it, and I threw it at my players.
Yeah, he stabbed it right in his chest.
I thought that was a fun detail. I was like, oh, I got these arrows lying around. I'll just wrap a little note around.
Yeah, might as well.
I did that.
And so then it became sort of a mystery that we had to solve, of going around and, like, interviewing and investigating these different possible suspects.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting because I thought what you did well is you tried to, like, add a little bit of detail about all three potential suspects into this note.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you picked up on that, because that was something I was like, is this going to be too subtle the way I did it?
Or I kind of picked up on it. I don't know if you remember, but you were like, what does this paper smell like, Piper?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, herbs? Maybe we should talk to the herbalist, I guess.
I thought I fed that one to you pretty well, because I made a... I mean, when else, what other reason would you have to mention that, like, oh, you unfurled the note and you noticed that it happens to smell of lavender and sage? Like, that's not really just like a detail that you would throw in unless it was significant. It was sort of a Chekhov's gun situation. I felt a Chekhov's smell.
Yeah. So we ended up investigating everybody. And in the end, it did turn out to be the one person that we had decided on originally, that it was going to be this lover scorned. But the way that, like, Sam kind of laid it out, it did kind of make me be like, oh, maybe he changed the bad guy completely. So that was kind of fun that it wasn't super obvious ahead of time.
That's really awesome. I'm glad that worked, because that was what I wanted. Was, yeah, for each of these, there were three suspects basically, and I wanted them all to seem like it really could have been one of them. And I wanted you especially to be like, I don't really know which one of these it is. Like, I kind of planted, as soon as you came into the town, the alderman mentioned that the ex-fiance had been helping with the wedding. He was paying for it. And I really wanted that to be something that was like, well, why would he be doing this if he's threatening? And to kind of push you guys to question that, because that seems like the obvious solution anyway. Mm-hmm. And I went and grabbed the note. I wanted to read the note because I thought this was pretty cool. So, you know, I did the old, like age a piece of paper and like scorch the edges and stuff. And I wrote this note on it. It said, "The union of these sinners is an unholy affront to order and decency. Should this marriage come to pass, the stars foretell that a great plague will be visited upon Sunstone and its people." Sunstone was the name of the village that we were in, of course.
Yeah.
And the sort of details were that, you know, one, there's the herbalist in town, and we noted that the parchment smelled of strongly of lavender and sage. So I was like, okay, cool. Like, maybe it's associated with her. The fact that the note said it's an unholy affront to order and decency. There was a notable religious figure in town that was, you know, kind of known for being overzealous. So I thought that would be kind of an interesting one. And then, of course, the fact that there is somebody trying to stop the wedding. It makes sense. It would be the ex-fiance. So there were kind of reasons to point at all three of these individuals, which, yeah, I'm glad that came through, because I was kind of worried. I was putting this all together earlier in the day, and I was like, I really hope that I don't have to be like, this thing model, yeah. You know?
What's that over there? So it was our friends Ellie and Devin's first time doing D&D, and I really loved the way that they, like, jumped into it. They really took to it really well. They kept mentioning, like, some details over and over again, and it just kind of became a joke. Like, the fact that their characters had known each other for 18 months. Like, that was very specific, and they ended up telling everybody that they met, that's how long they had known each other.
It was very funny. There were so many things that were kind of unexpected about their dynamic in the group. And that's what we always talk about, how much fun it is to play with new players, for exactly that reason, because, you know, everybody brings in something new. But when you play with the same players over and over again, you start to be able to kind of predict what that newness is going to look like. And so it's fun to have new, exciting curveballs thrown at us.
Exactly. Like that, yeah. So I thought they took to it really well, and it was really fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The ultimate climax to this did end up being that surprise. It was the ex-fiance that still did it. Mm-hmm. But I had kind of a cool twist on that I thought was interesting, was that I knew right away the party would assume it was the ex-fiance. So they were going to, of course, go and interrogate him and try to get him to confess, right? And so I thought, how could I possibly create a situation where they won't just immediately figure this out? Because, like, that's the obvious solution. So I wanted to – we had just got done watching season 2 of Homecoming on Amazon, which is a really, really cool show based on a really cool podcast about like a memory loss drug that's being tested on soldiers, essentially. And so I thought, okay, well, what's a great way to cover up a lie? To not even know you're lying. Mm-hmm. So there were other clues kind of scattered around. Like, you had noticed that, you know, lavender and sage, you remembered that you could make a weak memory loss potion based on those things. And what ended up happening was that the ex-fiance had been basically committing these kind of crimes. He'd been setting off these, like, weird things in town, these weird occurrences, leaving notes, leaving threats, things like that, and then taking a memory loss potion so that he didn't remember he did them. Mm-hmm. So when he was intimidated about them, he had no memory of actually doing it. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of thing, that it was a clever cover-up, I felt, to the crime. Now, if we start to really pick that apart, maybe it doesn't totally work, because he would have to know that he wants to do all this stuff.
Right, exactly.
Keep doing it or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I I figured it was like a fun little mystery to solve anyway.
And no, it was good for like a first session kind of like little woo kind of a thing. So that was nice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. D&D doesn't have to have rules, you know? We don't have to adhere to logic or reasoning. It can just be fun. Yeah.
Pay no attention to the flaws behind the curtain.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I'm glad you guys had fun with that.
And yeah.
I would love to hear you know, our listeners' kind of responses to that as well. You know, if that's sort of how you would have played it out in your head, or if you had different ideas about where we could have maybe gone with this. Mm-hmm. That's obviously always very fun for us to hear.
Yeah. It was also interesting. One thing that stood out to me too was I normally play as either semi-flawed or like edgy characters. And this is like the first time since starting D&D that I've ever played like a super nice, like well-meaning, good person who doesn't have like a troubled past.
Totally.
And so it was interesting to do that kind of role play of just being like, oh, well, I'm just helpful and open and I don't suspect people. And I'm just like, I don't know. It was different because I'm used to trying to be like smarmy and like sly and witty about things. And she's just kind of very like, I'll just help any way I can. Like, what's up, guys?
For sure. For sure. Yeah. We're revisiting this group later this week and probably will be the last time we play in this group for a little while, at least. Our friends are
moving
out of town, so we won't get to play with them for a while. We wanted to get a couple of sessions in so they could just kind of see how the game works. And, you know, if anybody in Colorado, if any of our listeners are looking for a couple of new players, let us know, because I think they'd love to jump in. I know we've got a few people out in Colorado that we've collaborated with and that we know here. So, yeah, that would be really cool. But we're going to try and maybe continue something online with them, I think. And I'm very excited to see where you go with this benevolent and helpful cleric that you're playing, because that's interesting to me to see you play a character that's kind of against type for you.
Definitely. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
Should we get into our actual topic now, though?
I think we should. Yeah, this is a really cool topic. This is a topic that kind of arose from our other campaign. Mm-hmm. I had talked about how I introduced a Medusa character that I wanted to be a good guy and kind of go against type here and subvert people's sort of expectations. And we got to talking about the nature of, like, you know, who is the monster and who is the man?
Exactly.
You know, like sympathetic monsters, we thought would be a really fun thing to kind of talk about on here. And I think we both underestimated the viability of this topic a little bit, because as we're going through coming up with our kind of inspirations.
Oh, I didn't underestimate it.
Oh, you didn't?
No, this is like such a classic trope. We're talking about sympathetic monsters, and that is like a tale as old as time, a Beauty and the Beast. It's always been around. And actually,
I definitely underestimated it.
So I didn't underestimate it because Beauty and the Beast, since I was very little, was kind of like been always the foundation of my favorite story.
Yeah.
Like, I loved the movie so much, the Disney animated one, that like pretty much every source of fiction that I actively go out and pursue, I'm trying to find something that's like kind of within that trope, because that's just what I love.
Sure. Yeah.
And for me, so actually, I want to do a quick early rec room. We talk about Lindsay Ellis quite a bit here, but that's because she's amazing. But she's a YouTuber on, she's a YouTuber, and she does these.
A YouTuber on YouTube.
On YouTube.
Of all places.
Whoa. No, but she has this one video essay that came out like maybe like a year ago, and it's called My Monster Boyfriend. And it was sort of like in reaction to the popularity and, you know, of The Shape of Water and that movie winning Best Picture, and people being like, why is it suddenly okay for like ladies to be in love with monsters? And her whole video essay is like, this is nothing new, this has been happening forever, and let me break down all these different examples and why we are drawn to the monster and what it symbolizes about culture and our perception of others. It's actually quite, it goes a lot in depth into this whole perception of the quote-unquote the other versus the self, and, you know, how you see people.
Things that are different are scary. They're not scary because they're actually a monster. They're scary because they're not like us.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very good video essay.
Yeah.
And I definitely recommend checking that out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But so, I mean, already, I think it's easy to say, I mean, Beauty and the Beast, number one for me. Yeah. First one to go to. There are people who don't find him sympathetic, and I think it really does depend on the rendition. I feel like Disney's animated Beast, I think he has a fair amount of sympathy.
I agree. I think he has a lot of growth.
Yes.
Is the thing. I mean, he starts out he's a bit of a prick, but that's obviously the point.
Exactly.
And I think they do a really good job of showing how he becomes sympathetic.
Right.
You start to see like, okay, this happened to him because he sort of sucked. But he obviously has the capacity to get better. And mm-hmm. as he actively does that, you start to really see like, okay, no, like people can grow and change and can become good, even if sort of in their core, they never really had that before.
And, see, I wouldn't say the thing about the, in the core, they never had that before, because the moral of Beauty and the Beast should not be, oh, I can fix him, because it's not about taking a bad person and like making them better. I think it's more about, I mean, if you really like look into it from a certain perspective, it's supposed to be that, yes, he was flawed, but also he, like, something causes you to be that way, right? Someone has been mistreated or neglected or
was just rich and never had anybody say no to him before.
Right. And so, like, the idea is, like, he can't just, like, suddenly become good. That has to have been within him, like, that potential all along. And so someone, like, helping him and being kind to him and helping him rediscover that side that maybe he didn't know, that's kind of ideally, I think, more
that's,
how it should be viewed.
I think I was maybe just channeling Mrs. Potts when she said, I think there's something there that wasn't there before.
Very nice. Well, that's good.
Yes.
What's your first big sympathetic monster that you want to talk about?
So you did mention it already, but The Shape of Water was mm-hmm. definitely one that I wanted to talk about.
Yep.
I think that's a kind of an obvious one, so I don't necessarily have to go super in-depth into that. But obviously, we're huge fans of Guillermo del Toro, and I think he's sort of the king of, one, interesting monsters, mm-hmm. just visually, but also giving personality to his monsters, you know, through their visual design and through the, you know, the kind of choices and the actions that they make in his stories. We obviously just love everything he does. So that's really all we need to say about it. That movie's incredible. It won Best Picture. Like, hot take for us to say that's a great movie, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, actually,
definitely go check that out if you haven't seen it yet.
It's so interesting to me, because kind of along what, like, Lindsay Ellis was talking about, is that I was really surprised that when that movie came out, that it was so well received.
Oh, I
and that it won
agree.
Best Picture.
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of thing that, like, monster lovers like me flock to the theaters because we're like, hooray, like, we love these, like, monster boyfriend movies. Like, this is what we're all about. But I feel like for the general audience, it's like, I'm very surprised that they were so open to it.
Yeah, like, woman has sex with fish is not really a super accessible tagline, I don't think.
Exactly,
right? For a lot of people.
So, but I think that then speaks to how the message is so relatable and how everyone, like, who has a good heart can really connect to stories like these.
For sure.
To say, oh my gosh, like, these two misfits could bond with one another and, like, find love, and when no one else, you know, cared about them, and it's,
absolutely,
yeah, it's the kind of beautiful love story that everyone wants to believe in.
And obviously, you know, this is Beauty and the Beast, you know? I mean, it really is, like, the same story, just like you kind of said. It is a really common trope. It's something that's explored in a lot of different sort of wrappings, basically. And I think something that I think is really worth kind of talking about in this sort of D&D context is that, you know, these sympathetic monsters, they can be, they can fill a lot of different sort of roles in your story. These monsters can be, you know, like party members, they can be love interests, they could be NPCs, they could be, you know, all of these sort of more like human type roles they can kind of take on. But they can also just be, in another example that I have here, Toothless from How to Train Your Dragon. They can start out as just kind of an animal that you become friends with, and they can be more of like a traveling companion or like a partner or a, like a pet almost.
Yeah.
Is also kind of a fun way to sort of realize this trope a little bit. So that it can fill so many different spaces in your story, I think, is definitely, this is a good way to sort of highlight that.
Definitely. I feel like Toothless, especially. So I like the way that from the first How to Train Your Dragon to the second How to Train Your Dragon, Toothless kind of gets to revisit this like sympathetic monster trope.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, that's what he is. He starts off as the scary monster that should be hunted. Then Hiccup bonds with him and he's like, oh, now he's our friend.
Absolutely.
And so when we enter the second movie, we now know him as a good guy and we think that element is not going to reemerge. But I love, love, love spoilers for How to Train Your Dragon 2. The whole element where that bad guy can like hypnotize or brainwash
dragons,
the dragons, and he takes over Toothless's mind and forces him to kill Hiccup's dad.
Yeah.
He murders his dad.
Yeah.
And Hiccup still loves him in the end. He's like, you killed my father, but I guess we're still pals because you weren't in control of yourself. But like when you see him in that like kind of blind monster rage, and he's just like nothing but like power and like ferocity, like it's really exciting and cool
and
very tragic and sad.
I agree. I think it's important to or it's really interesting to have two sides of that coin, you know, yes. for a monster to be sympathetic in the way that you can say, well, oh, you know, you don't really know him. He looks scary, but he's actually got a heart of gold. Mm-hmm. But then it's also important to have, well, he looks scary because he also can just murder you if right. he wants to, you know, like he acts friendly because he in his true nature is friendly, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's misunderstood, but the scariness of him isn't entirely benign.
Exactly.
Is really cool to me, I think.
I think that's one of the reasons why I've always been drawn to this kind of a character. There's something about the idea of, like, because I would always want to view them first as, like, a good person, a potential yeah. friend, like, maybe a lover, like, things like this. But it's like, there's this kind of, this power that's kind of bubbling beneath the surface, and that like yeah. if any time like that power could be unleashed, or they could tap into it, and suddenly they're like unstoppable and fearsome, and it's like, ooh, this is someone on your for side sure. like this is really cool.
And that's a fun dramatic moment in your stories, definitely, you know, unveiling that, you know, maybe you never really you stop thinking of them as a monster
right.
because you spend so much time with them being friendly and fun and kind of goofy, and then you kind of remember, like, oh yeah, they actually are, you know, they're huge and powerful.
Right.
And yeah, that's a fun sort of turn you can insert.
Absolutely.
In
I think I tap into that quite frequently when playing Willa in our
yeah.
other campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever she, like, you know, drinks blood and kind of goes sort of crazy vampire mode.
You love that so much.
I
like,
do.
Every time Willa turns, you know, she's like, ooh, time to drink some blood. You know, like
yeah.
she just loses it. And I can tell you're having so much fun with
it's
that.
It's a lot of fun. I like it. So one of my next examples that I want to yeah. touch on, which I feel like is maybe one of the less commonly known ones from what is probably on our big list here, but there's an anime based off of a manga called The Ancient Mage's Bride, and yeah. the main character in that is a guy named Elias, or Elias, however you want to pronounce his name.
I
but he
Elias.
Elias?
Eli, I don't know.
Elias?
Elias Proteus, the actor? Yeah.
But so this manga was, the author wrote it because she had always loved Beauty and the Beast stories, but she didn't like how the beast would be turned into, like, a man, a human at the end. She wanted the creature to stay a creature, because it's about loving you for who you are and not changing you.
Yeah.
And so this, you should just definitely check it out, but essentially, it's like in this world of, you know, magic and mages, and the other main character, the love interest, is this young woman named Chise, and she has this ability to, like, see into the fairy world, and she can be used sort of like a magic conduit, because yeah. they kind of observe the laws of alchemy here, where, like, if you use magic, you have to, like, give something up, but if a mage has a conduit like her that they can use through, then that's kind of like a power source,
yeah.
essentially.
She's like a battery that
she
carries around, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And so he is this, like, 7.5 foot tall. They call him the, like, thorn demon. But he has this big, like, skull face. It's kind of long, like a wolf. And yeah. he's got these huge horns that curve out the back.
It kind of looks like he just has, like, a cow skull for a head.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah,
it's very horns. Cool. But yeah. otherwise, he wears, this, like, very, like, these very fine clothes. It's very Beauty and the Beast in that way. But Elias is, like, an ancient demon, and he has many forms that he takes. And when he is not in control of himself, these other transformations kind of come through.
Yeah.
So sometimes he, like, has this long, like, snake-like body and, like, these giant exposed ribs and this huge, like, frill of feathers and thorns and hair, and he's got these giant claws, and he just turns into a absolute monster. There's yeah. like zero trace of humanity in his design.
He's very, like, Junji Ito, like, stretched and weird and, like,
yeah.
you know, yeah,
it's cool. really spooky and cool. But the whole thing about, like, their story is that at the beginning, I mean, I guess Chise knows that he's kind of this weird thing from the start, but she has so many personal problems that she's sorting through. Like, she thinks that she's a freak because she's been treated that way her whole life, because
yeah.
people don't understand her powers and all these other things. And so when she sees him in his horrifying form, she doesn't run from him because she's like, oh, you're just as dark on the outside as I feel on the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have these, like, they can bond and connect with one another in this very unique way.
I also think that she sort of fulfills a trope that I think is hilarious of the, the very normal, like, attractive, like, you know, like, regular looking person that, like, probably doesn't have, you know, that's like, I'm so weird and, like, how could anyone like me? And it's like, you're, cause you're, like, pretty normal looking and very likable looking. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's her... like the girl in, Ready Player One, how she's like, I'm so hideous. And she has, like, a tiny little, very faint birthmark on her face.
Yeah,
and it's like,
right.
Yeah, I'm sure that makes it really hard for people to get to know you.
Exactly. Well, so with Chise, it's not so much that, like, she has anything physically wrong with her.
Yeah.
It's more that she, like, she just has a lot of traumatic experiences from her childhood. She's just constantly, like, swarmed by weird ghosts and spirits and demons who are trying to bite her face off. And she's, like, screaming, and everyone's like, what's wrong with this insane person screaming at nothing? So that's kind of her trauma issues.
For sure.
Yeah.
We're not trying to belittle the traumas of anyone who is haunted by thousands of demonic ghosts. We totally stand with you, listeners, if that's an experience that you've had.
Exactly. So if you're very interested in a new kind of take on the Beauty and the Beast story in which the Beast does not turn back and it's about people loving each other despite all their weirdness.
Yeah.
So definitely go and check out The Ancient Magus Bride.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool.
Either the manga or the anime, both very cool.
Okay, so my next recommendation here is actually, this is kind of a beloved one, I think, for a lot of people, is The Iron Giant.
Yes.
I think that's such a great story of, this kind of fulfills sort of the friendship, like, you know, companionship, like partner, like pet kind of role, I think. Hogarth meeting this giant, you know, machine of war from the stars. You know, nobody really knows who he is, but he looks like he would be this big kind of Cold War, like Russian space fighting mech or something like that. But he's just a person, just like, you know, like you or I. He just wants to hang out in the woods and hang out with his little friend Hogarth and watch like deer or whatever it is that they have fun times. And
talk about Superman.
Exactly. And I think that sort of struggle of, you know, being in a there's a lot more pressure, I think, in this story than you know, like Beauty and the Beast is generally pretty isolated. He's locked away in his castle, typically in that trope, and he only faces conflict kind of at the climax of that story, or at least like external conflict with actual like people out in the world. And something that I think is interesting about The Iron Giant is that there's kind of this constant, like, we have to sort of hide you away because we know people don't understand you, or we have to help people to understand you. And that's kind of a through line of the entire story. I think that would be a really cool thing to do. You know, imagine playing in a setting where like Warforged as a race are like super uncommon and nobody understands them, or even just playing with any monstrous race, having a vampire in your party or having like a werewolf in your party and knowing that they're a good person, but you kind of have to hide that away from everyone else.
Yeah.
And when it does come out accidentally, how do you convince people that no, they're not scary. They're not just this horrible monstrous beast. They're my friend. They're a person just like you or me.
Exactly.
And I think The Iron Giant is a great example of that.
Totally. I think there's something, one of the things that's really interesting about the exploration of him in that film is the idea that, like, the personality that we get to know him by, I feel like the movie says, is kind of like, well, it makes you question, is it a result of the dent in his head? Because once the dent is fixed, he goes into war mode, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, are we supposed to believe that, you know, him as a war machine is like his original state of mind?
Yeah.
And so this like dent has made him, oh, I can now like learn anew, I can have my personality and all this stuff. But then, isn't it, if I'm remembering right, even though the dent is undone and he goes into war mode, he can still, like, he breaks out of that kind of trance because of his relationship with Hogarth?
The way that I kind of understood it was that he was, maybe it was that he was built as just like an AI, and then they programmed him, or, you know, whoever programmed him to be like a fighting machine with like a chip in his brain or something like that. And the dent like breaks that chip.
Mm-hmm.
So he now has like control over himself. He still has all his fighting capabilities, but he doesn't have to do that.
Right.
So he can kind of go back and forth and do whatever he wants. Was the way that I sort of interpreted it. I also haven't seen that movie in a very long time, so
we should watch it soon.
We should watch that movie soon. It's very, very good.
But I think that's a really cool way to explore your character's identity, is him having to question about himself, is like, this is what I was made for, but is that who I am?
Totally.
That kind of a thing, I think, is really cool about the kind of misunderstood and sympathetic monster character.
Totally. And having someone like, you know, like with Toothless or like with Iron Giant, having someone else who can come in and sort of throw a wrench in the gears and say, I know what you are and I have power over you. I can unleash the beast from within you and kind of, you know, let everyone see you for what you are, yeah, that kind of thing. I think that's an interesting antagonistic standpoint, and that's something that's very, that would be very, very fun to throw into any story like this. That was something that I kind of wanted to happen with Willa. We early on agreed that, sort of balancing Willa's, vampire abilities in our campaign, one of the things we agreed on as sort of a drawback for her, since we didn't want to have to deal with her being like completely debilitated by light or like having to drink blood constantly, we wanted to have kind of like a casual vampire experience. We decided that it would be interesting if other vampires could fairly easily have control over her. And that was something that I wanted to happen in our last campaign that never ended up kind of coming to bear, was the bad guy that we were all sort of fighting, mm-hmm, in that session. I wanted him to at one point turn to Willa and just be like, you're on my side now. And she would go into her rage, yeah, and not be able to control who she's fighting for or fighting with or, yeah, whatever. That's a really cool thing to do with monstrous. It comes built in,
right,
sort of to,
exactly,
the monster archetype there.
So you know what this is making me think of, which wasn't originally on my list, but it just popped into my head. From Moana, our antagonist there is Te Ka.
Yeah.
Who is actually just like she's what Tafiti becomes when her heart is stolen.
Yes.
But there's an amazing line in that movie that, like, when I saw it in theaters, it gave me shivers and it brought tears to my eyes. But when Moana is like slow-mo walking towards Te Ka, she's like, yeah, charging at her down that like pathway parted by the water,
yeah,
and she's singing her song really slowly. She says that line and it's so beautiful, and I think it really speaks to a lot of these characters, where she says, they stole the heart from inside you, but this does not define you.
Yeah.
And like that idea of like, do not become what people see of you, or
for
like,
sure,
what they try to make you be, like,
for sure,
yeah, I just love that. It's like, you are who you are,
yeah,
and your traumas don't define you.
And that,
I love that.
I think that can work in so many, you can kind of fit that into so many different slots, right? You can say you can overcome your true nature, or you can overcome people's expectations of you, or,
right,
you can overcome your own sort of, you know, fears, or, you know, if you think I look evil, I must be evil, I have to be a bad guy,
yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm,
you can overcome all of that, and that's just so, that's so satisfying.
I know.
Think like that's the kind of character growth that I think that's a lot easier probably to portray in D&D than a lot of other types of growth, because, you know, by nature, D&D involves a lot of sort of physical conflict, and like, you know, being able to explore this character through fighting and through their monstrous abilities is very easy to do,
mm-hmm,
and probably a lot more comfortable for a lot of people than, you know, having really extensive kind of chatty like dialogues about,
yeah,
about their personalities and their character traits and things like that. So that would be something that would be a great thing to explore,
yeah,
if you're wanting to have fun character growth, but you don't want to write a novel about your characters, you know, backstory, history and stuff like that. That might be sort of an entry level way to do that.
Definitely. And I think that concept, that's another huge reason why I'm so drawn to like monster characters, is that idea of, I mean, there's such a hope and optimism, I think, of this,
yeah,
idea of, you know, you can be better than succumbing to your lower instincts or,
yes,
whatever. Whereas I feel like when you have like good guy characters who turn bad, that's simply out of weakness because they weren't strong enough to, you know, resist these like worser urges or lesser and evil thoughts. They weren't strong enough,
yeah,
to be better. And so a monster character who is like an upstanding citizen or a good person, it's like, well, no, that person is twice as strong as the average person because they had to overcome so much like hate and discrimination against,
absolutely,
them just to prove that they are equal, if not better than the people who are pointing at them with their pitchforks and everything.
And I love that you point out the idea of having a sort of a mirror that says, well, there was this evil person that gave in to their, you know, to their desire to be monstrous and evil. That a lot of these characters come with sort of a foil to them. You know, the Beast has Gaston,
right,
who, you know, he is the actual monster that everyone sees the Beast as. He,
mm-hmm,
is this like just kind of brutish, like crude and like awful guy, right? And the Beast is the one who has kindness inside of him and wants to express that. Maybe Gaston has kindness inside of him, but he clearly doesn't choose to express that,
right,
obviously. You,
yes,
know, he lets his monstrous personality aspects take over.
Mm-hmm. I'm a very similar situation with like Quasimodo and,
yeah,
Frollo, which of course you quoted,
yes,
at the beginning. I mean, that's like the perfect sort of like monster man situation.
That was definitely one that I wanted to talk about as well here. And again, that one kind of goes without saying, is the, you know, the who is the monster, who is the man. Like, it's just such a base fundamental exploration of that. You can look evil and still be great. We can say that about literally every one of these. We can stop saying that probably because it's really obvious for all of these. The next one that I wanted to talk about, this will be the last one that I think I want to talk about really at length here. Okay. I have a bunch more still. Maybe I'll just kind of like
we'll do a lightning
list
round.
Quick, but
yeah.
I really, really wanted to talk about, this is probably my favorite of all of these, the Great Grey Wolf Sif from Dark Souls 1.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, we can't get through an episode of me talking about how great Dark Souls is, but Dark Souls, every character in that game has just such an interesting, complex backstory, but especially the story of Sif and his friend, the knight Artorias, is so cool. Basically, Artorias was, for anyone not familiar, this incredible, powerful, noble knight who said, the abyss is, it's creeping into our world, and someone has to go in and stop it. And so he basically... He surrenders himself to the darkness so that he can hold it at bay and protect everyone else from it. And his friend Sif, this giant, like, monstrous, huge-looking gray wolf, who he's actually not particularly monstrous. He's just a wolf, but he's very, very large, and he carries a sword.
In his teeth.
In his teeth, which is very cool. he basically said, I will guard your grave so that no one else can follow after you, because the power, he leaves a ring behind that if you wear that ring, you can traverse the abyss. Sif says, I will protect your grave basically till the end of time so that no one else can follow you in. And you have to go and get this ring to progress through the story of the game. And when you get there, Sif is, you know, waiting for you essentially, but he's not trying to fight you like for the same reasons that every other monster in Dark Souls is trying to fight you. He's trying to fight you because he's protecting his friend.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to protect you, honestly. Yeah. But it's just a thing you have to do. And so the fight is so, there's so much depth to it, right? And something that I think is always really difficult every time I do, I try to rush through this fight as fast as I can, because if you get Sif below like 10% of his health or something like that, his animation changes, and instead of walking around, he like limps around sadly and like swings his attacks really slowly. He's so like weakened. It's really, really sad. They also added into the game with the DLC for Dark Souls 1, you can actually go back in time in the DLC, and you can fight Artorias when he was still kind of walking around in the world, and you can actually rescue Sif from the abyss, because Sif at one point had like gone in to try and find Artorias. And if you do that before you do the Sif fight in the main game, it changes the cutscene so that when you get to Artorias's grave and Sif comes out, he like sniffs you because you're familiar, and then he like howls at the moon and then kind of like sadly starts the fight.
Aww.
It's really, really well done. It's such a powerful fight. I love that character so much. And all of this happens without any of them saying a word.
Yeah.
It's really, really neat. I love that.
Dark Souls has such good storytelling.
It's incredible. We recommended this so many times, but if, you know, I ever mention anything about Dark Souls that you want to learn more about, go check out Vati Vidya on YouTube.
He has
this really incredible series called Prepare to Cry, where he takes all of the bosses and a bunch of the characters from Dark Souls and just explains why they're so fucking interesting and cool.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful. So... That is my big like headline recommendation is Great Grey Wolf Sif and Artorias.
Nice. Yeah. I think, okay, so one of my last ones that I want to talk about in detail, speaking of Guillermo del Toro, who yes. I would confidently say is the king of monsters.
Oh yeah, certainly.
Yes.
He and Godzilla.
Yeah.
Are right up there.
Exactly. I think del Toro could take Godzilla in a fight.
Yes.
He would just like hug him and he'd be like, oh, we're not going to fight anymore.
He would also
we're going to be buds.
Yeah, he'd send all of his action figures that because he's obsessed with collecting action figures. He'd line them all up and they'd shoot little lasers at Godzilla.
Pew pew. So Guillermo del Toro partnered with Netflix to create an animated, I wouldn't even call this kids. It's kind of more young adult. But a series on Netflix, it's called Troll Hunters.
Yes.
And there are a lot that is just constantly giving us characters who look monstrous but aren't, and
for sure,
all kinds of things. But one of my favorite characters from that is this character. His name is Strickler, and he starts off, his arc is very interesting. He's sort of an antagonist, but kind of an anti-hero who turns into a good guy. It's really, so he's, the main character is this high school student named Tim Lake, who is chosen to become the troll hunter. He's the guardian of all of these, like, troll people that live underneath his town.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to learn how to, you know, fight other bad trolls and save the good trolls and do all kinds of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he has, there's a principal in his school who at the beginning of the show kind of is inserting himself like very genuinely as sort of this like pseudo father figure.
Yeah.
Jim, he has a single mom there. His dad like up and left them. And so he has this kind of nice connection with Strickler of being like, oh, I'm giving you guidance and I'm just, you know, we're just good guys and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But then it's revealed that Strickler is actually he's a changeling. And so he can assume human form and insert himself in different cultures. But then he has this like troll, like identity that he can transform into. And he's like very like kind of gaunt with these huge horns and like these big wings that are revealed.
He looks kind of like a gargoyle,
yeah,
a vampire sort of. Yeah, he's pretty cool.
Exactly. And yeah, his whole motivation is really interesting because at first his thing is that he's working for like the main villain of the show because he is trying to kind of fight for changeling rights, essentially.
Because everybody hates changelings.
Right, everyone hates changelings. Yeah. Humans and trolls both hate changelings because they are kind of in the middle and they don't belong anywhere. And so he is kind of fighting for his people and he's willing to do like really bad stuff, including like literally trying to kill his like pseudo son just to like, you know, win and things like that. But he genuinely falls in love with Jim's mom, which is like a really interesting plot of like him and Barbara. And at some point, Barbara like finds out who he is and she realizes, you know, that he was working for the bad guys. And she's like, I hate you. I never want to see you again. But then later he comes back to help with like, you know, fighting in this overall cause and they decide to forgive each other. And then he becomes sort of this like, again, sort of another like teacher to Jim, but he's like trying to teach him how to fight dirty and like he's like, you can't win if you fight like a noble person. You have to be willing to like make sacrifices and
like
do
me.
Things.
Sometimes
exactly.
You have to kill your surrogate son.
Right. Like if you have to kill me to win, then that's okay, I guess. Yeah. Like it's really interesting, I think. Because he's a very like dual he brings a lot of duality to it.
I think that the sort of the long form TV show format is a really good analogy to the way that these kinds of things can work in Dungeons and Dragons. Because,
yes,
you know, with a movie, you get 2 hours, 2.5 hours or whatever to explore this idea in a way that the complexity of it due to these time constraints is really limited. With D&D, much like a show, it can just go on forever. You know, you meet every week with your group and this week there's a new update and next week there's going to be another development and the week after that there's, you know, maybe there's going to be a twist where things kind of revert back and you can have very complex relationships like that where sometimes a guy's a good guy and sometimes they're a bad guy and they kind of go back and forth and they do things that are shocking and surprising and you never really know what side they're on. And I think that type of story works very well in D&D in the same ways it does in a show like this.
I agree. Yeah. And they just explored him really well. And he's voiced by the guy who was the hunter in Jumanji, whoever that actor is. So he has this great, very sophisticated...
Van Pelt.
He has this very sophisticated British accent and just a really cool monster design when he transforms.
For sure. Yeah. I like him. I like the visual design in that a lot. There's a lot of good... Nick Offerman is in that at some point, isn't he?
He's in Three Below, the second version, the second show that comes out.
Okay,
but they have... Kelsey Grammer is a voice in it. Ron Perlman is a voice in it.
Yeah. Of course, Ron Perlman's going to... It's a Guillermo del Toro.
Yes, of course.
So Ron Perlman's obviously involved, but
there's a lot of people who have voices on that show. It's very good.
Yeah, it is really good. We definitely recommend
The late Anton Yelchvich.
Anton Yelchin.
Yelchin. Yeah. He was the voice of Jim before he tragically died, and then they brought in a new guy, but they attributed the show to him after his passing, which was very nice.
A really great cast and a really fun show. And
It
does walk the line between kids and adults entertainment. There's like kind of kids like humor in it sometimes, but there's definitely more adult stories. And I think that's something that, you know, cartoons aren't just for kids, obviously. Like, you know, we talk all the time about Miyazaki and about, you know, like the power of storytelling through this medium, how you're not restricted when you are able to use this medium because you can express things in ways that would be, you know, financially or like physically prohibitive.
Exactly.
Literally
could not make the show with live action.
Yeah. It would never work.
Exactly. The environments, the character design, like it has to be animated.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, I have a few other ideas here.
Let's do a back and forth lightning round.
Yeah. I've got, all right. The first one that I had was Sweetums, the Muppet. The giant 7 foot tall monster. He's just a big shaggy guy. He's like made of beards is what it kind of looks
made
like.
Made of beards. He is.
Yeah.
He's always
like
running after everybody.
Yeah. He picks up big heavy logs and throws them around and stuff. He's always kind of like the physical guy who just like solves problems for the most. He shows up and he's like, I'm Sweetums. I love you guys. And then he runs off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's his little catchphrase. Yeah. I love you guys.
Yeah, it's great. What do you got next here?
Obvious throwaway one, King Kong. We just have to say it out
loud. Of course. To kind of connect with that, most Godzilla monsters. Godzilla has a lot of friends. Mothra, Rodan.
A lot of friends.
He does. I mean, sometimes they're friends, sometimes they're enemies, but a lot of them are, even Godzilla himself, he's kind of like a neutral force. You know, he's not a person typically who comes in and just destroys things for the fun of it. He's sort of this like fundamental like element of balance in the universe.
Exactly.
At least I think the most interesting portrayal of Godzilla. That's obviously not always how he is portrayed, but I love that version of him. I also think the Ninja Turtles. Ninja Turtles are totally like horrifying monsters.
Especially the new one that we just rewatched.
Horrible, horrifying designs. I hate the designs so much.
I like them.
I don't
like
care for
big
it.
Big monsters.
I find it to be very unpleasant.
I said this to you the other day. So I threw the I think it's like from 2014
or 16 or something like that.
Yeah, 2013. I threw on that quote unquote live action remake on TV because it was free. And Sam walks in and he's like, "You're watching this?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "My fifth time that I've seen this movie." And I was like, "Dude, like when I saw the trailers for this, I was like, what? Big hulking monsters and a beautiful lady? Like, sign me up. I gotta go watch this crap."
But at what cost, Piper? At what cost? Only your immortal soul, basically.
No, I'm fine. It's good.
Yeah, not the worst, but I don't know.
All right. My next one is The Hound, Sander Clegane.
Oh, of course.
He's kind of physically a monster with his half-burned face.
I mean, I think he's a monster in just as much of a way as, like, Quasimodo is, or as...
Exactly.
You know.
I mean, I love his whole thing, and I have not read the books. I've heard some people say that in the books he's not as likable as he is in the show, but based on the show stuff, he's my number one dude in Game of Thrones. I love that he's a merciless killer, but he's got his own fears and his own traumas from his childhood. He loves Sansa. I don't care what anybody says. Sure. I'm so there for it.
I know that the sort of protective father, like father-daughter thing is definitely a favorite trope of yours. I think another good example of that that's obviously recently relevant is Joel and Ellie from The Last of Us.
Yeah.
Joel is absolutely a monster. Mm-hmm. Joel is a terrible person.
I feel like most of the people in Last of Us are monsters.
Yeah, they all are. But you come to love him because you sort of see like, okay, well, he has the capacity to care for Ellie. And basically the thing that's terrible about him is that he's just willing to sacrifice literally anyone and anything else for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no line he won't cross for Ellie, which obviously goes on to cause a lot of problems in a second game. So
yeah. Well, is that your next one, or should I?
Well,
have...
you can go ahead. I mean, I'll that's just say, basically just the
Abby. Yeah, definitely a sympathetic monster in my opinion. In our opinion,
yeah.
I feel like that's what the game's all about.
Spoilers for The Last of Us 2. I mean, you know, it's been out for a couple weeks now. That we're not going to go in and like to you know tell you exactly what happens in the game, but I think everybody at least now who's planning on playing that is aware enough at least of the perspective switch that you know you start playing the game as Abby pursuing. Or as Ellie pursuing mm-hmm. Abby out of revenge, and then about halfway through the game, you switch perspectives and you you revisit everything that you've done as Ellie, basically from Abby's perspective.
Yes.
And so it sort of is attempting to humanize this character that was previously just viewed as the, you know, this merciless, like, one-dimensional villain.
Right.
And I think they do a really good job of it.
I agree.
Don't
well,
listen to the bad reviews on it.
Yeah, no, the game, what it does literally is it just draws constant parallels between Abby and Ellie.
Yes.
Like, their experiences are so similar. And that's, I think, the whole, like, story of the game is that, like, everybody in the world that they live in, everyone does horrible things to survive for the people that they love.
But do you let those things define you?
Yeah,
do you
exactly.
let them control you in the way that Ellie kind of does in her quest for revenge?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
very, very
wonderful,
good.
Wonderful.
What else you got?
I have got, I wanted to mention our friend Noel Vampire on Twitter. He actually mentioned, we went on Twitter and we asked for sympathetic monsters, and he said, me. I'm a horrifying Noel vampire monster, but I like a hug now and again. I thought that was funny. We wanted to give you a shout out, buddy.
I also have Goliath from Gargoyles.
Cool. I wanted to mention them as well. I kind of figured you would. So
yeah.
I've got Stitch from Lilo and Stitch.
Cute. Yes. Oh my god. I can't believe I didn't think of that one.
I know, right? We have like five Disney examples in here.
Right.
It took us this long to get to Stitch. I actually have. Two more quick ones here. I'll just run through these and then you can run through the rest of yours maybe.
Cool.
Appa from Avatar. Big flying cat monster thing. Very cute, very cuddly.
Is it ever great considered friend. A monster though? Isn't it always
like,
just a nice big fluffy guy?
He's not viewed as a monster in that people are like scared of him that he's an antagonist, but he is like
a beast,
visually like a big beast. Yeah, okay. I don't know. And he's very friendly. He's sympathetic. And then basically any animal or animal-like creature from any Ghibli movie.
Yeah.
pretty much definitely always is going to be a complicated character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My last ones are, I have obviously Hellboy has to be mentioned.
For sure.
I've got Doc Ock from Spider-Man 2. I love how literally when he dies and sacrifices himself as he goes into the river, he's like, I will not die, a monster.
Yes, exactly.
And he like sacrifices himself to so everyone else can live. Wonderful. Love it. And then since we never have female characters to talk about in these things, I'm going to end with the Wicked Witch of the West, aka Elphaba, as she is explored through the musical through and the novel Wicked.
Of course.
Yes.
That is a
which
cool one.
I love that. Okay, it really depends. We've talked a lot about how I'm not crazy about being like, ooh, here's a sympathetic backstory that I'm making up for this famous
Maleficent
villain.
Doesn't need that.
Right, it's like, if you're the mistress of evil, let her own that and be more powerful and respectable as someone who's just like, I'm bad and I love it. Like, just let her be evil. We don't need her sad story that like led up to this, in my opinion.
Sometimes it is genuinely much more interesting and effective to have someone be just one-dimensionally terrible.
Exactly. Yeah. I really love the exploration of Elphaba's character and her journey, and I think just because it's done so well in the musical of, you know, her suffering that she goes through to make her like the way that she is.
Yeah.
And even in the end, it kind of reveals she's not actually doing bad things. There are just like it's kind of this goes back to this idea of who's telling the story, right?
Yes.
If it's told from the loser's perspective, but in, you know, The Wizard of Oz, they are the good guys. Then they're like, oh, well, she's responsible for all these bad things that happen. And the story kind of tries to flip it in the musical and say, actually, she tried to prevent most of these things, but people couldn't believe that she was a good person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Twisted also is just wicked for Jafar.
Exactly.
Essentially,
which
we've talked about on the show before, but I think that would also be kind of a fun thing to explore is sort of the reverse sympathetic monster, right? You start out as a character that is very sympathetic and Walter White style, you slowly move towards becoming evil.
Definitely.
You know, if you want to have a fun roleplay experience, maybe instead of overcoming your nature as you know, what people think you are, people think you're like evil and terrifying and monstrous, maybe you embrace that and you say, okay, I want to be evil and terrifying and monstrous. That would also be a very fun type of character to play.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so actually I've thought about this a little bit. I love kind of tragic endings. I love happy endings, but I think tragic endings can be so satisfying.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I loved Endgame so much.
Infinity War
so much. Yes. That ends with a snap. Thanos wins. I was like, I don't need to see any other Marvel movies. This can be the end for me. Like, let's just have this be the ending. What if that's how it was?
Yeah.
Because I just think it's very impactful and intense.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that we're left without, like, feeling satisfied.
Yeah.
You know, people are waiting for something good to happen. And so one thing that I actually kind of don't like is when people are too obsessed with the need to like have things end their way, even if it doesn't make sense narratively for that to happen.
Yeah.
We were kind of talking about this with like people, you know, who loved Daenerys and like put her up on a pedestal and then she snapped and became evil and they were mad about that.
And we were like, we've been looking out for this for like 4 years, you guys.
Well, that's the thing is like, I feel like it's more interesting to see a person be corrupted than to see them be like, oh, like she was like, you know, queen the entire time and then she kept going up to the top and then she won and everything was peaceful. Like, that's not an interesting story.
Yeah. That would have been the most boring possible conclusion you could have possibly given us, I think.
Right. Obviously, granted, the showrunners could have stretched it out a little bit more so we could have more time with Daenerys the Mad Queen before she was just instantly killed. Like, that would have been kind of cool, actually.
I would have loved to have a whole season of her just being insane.
That'd
I think
be great.
It would have been much more fun to have. You know, they were supposed to do two more seasons, right? To have had season 8 had been the season where she flips.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that, you know, they made a lot of, like, mistakes with how they actually explored that and portrayed that. But I have no problem at all with
Same.
The fact that that happened.
Exactly.
I'm glad that happened. And I think that was something that, like I said, we had been, all of our friends who were like, oh, I love Daenerys, we were like, we told you so.
We're like, ooh, just wait. Like, this is coming. We know it.
But I would have loved to have seen her become the new, like, main antagonist of the show. You know, she comes in and she's got dragons so she can wipe out the Night King and, like, you know, destroy all this, all the evils in the world. But then she takes their place. It's sort of like when Galadriel is talking about how she can't take the One Ring because she would become this corrupted, evil, this evil, like, goddess, beautiful and terrible to behold.
Yeah.
And she has that cool sort of monologue with Frodo in front of her, like, mirror. And I think it would have been really fun to just have two seasons of that, of her being completely corrupted.
I agree.
And the things that all the people around her have to do to kind of correct that, which, you know, we got half an hour of roughly.
Right.
In the last episode, sort of squeezed in.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's kind of contrary to our topic today of, like, yes, sympathetic monsters.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think it's important to keep in mind, when is it good to make something sympathetic, and when is it more kind of powerful or impactful to make them not sympathetic?
For sure.
Like, let them just be evil, because that's equally interesting. And like, we have to ask ourselves why.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I think with all of those ideas sort of laid out in front of us here, fanned out like so many decks of cards, we should go ahead and start just giving our prompts out and creating on our own here.
Absolutely. Okay. Do you want the prompt first, or should I have to take the first one?
Yeah, I'll take the first prompt, I think.
Okay. I want you to choose evens or odds.
Ooh. Oh, you're spicing it up this week. Okay.
Yes.
We're gonna do odds.
Odds?
Yeah.
Okay. You get the word pair.
Pair. Ooh, everything went all pear-shaped. cool. All right, so let's maybe define here, while I'm kind of thinking about this, how exactly we are going to manifest these creatures. What my thought process is, I think it would be fun to create this sympathetic monster, and then have maybe a little bit of a story about how they're kind of discovered by their companion, right? Whether it's a love interest that comes and says, "I see you for what you are," or whether it's like Toothless, how Toothless meets, you know, Hiccup, and they become kind of like fast friends or whatever. I think that's probably the most interesting way to explore this topic, is kind of have that sort of meeting story and see where things go from here.
Cool, I like
it.
And
then we can sort of decide, well, do they end up actually staying sympathetic? Do they end up kind of turning at some point? Like, where is the most interesting drama there? So
yeah.
I want to go in a direction. What I'm thinking of is, so when I think of the word pear, I think of like a grove of pear trees, right? Mm. So maybe my creature is like a guardian of this grove. Maybe it's like a great deer or something, like a great dire deer.
Ooh.
But I don't think that it looks like a normal deer. It people would definitely have to be obviously afraid of it and scared of it. So maybe instead of just having, you know, one set of antlers, it has this incredible, like, mighty rack of antlers, but it also has little kind of mini antler spikes, like, all along its back.
Cool.
Like alligator style or something. So it's got
cool,
like little like bits of like bone and spike and protrusions coming out all over it. So it looks horrifying and monstrous, but really all it does is it just wanders around these groves of trees, protecting them from, you know, evil magics or, you know, people who would want to come and chop down the trees. And I think what would be a cool sort of starting point is maybe it gets caught in a hunter's trap or something like that, and someone comes upon it, like, you know, like Marahute style, mm-hmm, in The Rescuers Down Under, and frees it from the trap. And maybe it's just a little child. Maybe it's the owner of the grove. It's their, like, son, who they always say, you're their son or daughter, or their, you know, whatever. They're never allowed to go into the grove at night, mm-hmm, because there's this great beast that's there that we're all afraid of that will kill us as soon as look at us. And it wanders out into the grove at night, finds this massive beast pinned down in a hunter's snare, and frees it, and then becomes this beast's friend. And they kind of like team up to help protect the grove together.
Very cool. I like that a lot. I have a really fun deer fact for you that could help
with the
visualization of why maybe people think it looks so frightening.
Yes.
So one thing that happens to deer is when they're antlers grow back every year. They're first covered in this velvet that has all these like blood vessels in it. And that's what helps the antlers and the bone underneath to grow. And then once the antlers harden, they scrape off the velvet, mm-hmm, and it often comes off in these, like, it looks like strings of flesh, and their antlers are like covered in blood because they were like filled with all these blood vessels. And people sometimes will like look at pictures of that. They'll be like, whoa, did this deer like kill somebody? And it's like, no, it's just shedding its velvet, but it looks rather gruesome and scary.
It got into like a horrible like deer joust, and it
or,
you know, it's got a million tines, it could spear a million guys all at once.
Well, it's the thing, maybe somebody saw it when it was shedding its velvet and they were like, oh, this thing was dripping with blood and it had this like ragged flesh hanging from, ooh, like the antlers that are ripping out of its back.
Okay, I like that.
And like maybe they think like a tree is trying to explode out of this creature.
Maybe. Yeah, but that's really cool.
Yeah, but it's actually, he's like, yo, you just saw me on a bad day, I'm just shedding my velvet.
Okay, I do like the idea that in connection with this forest, mm-hmm. The antlers would literally be like trees growing out of its, or they would at least grow to look like that.
Yeah.
There's a Pokemon called Sawsbuck that's basically this, that has antlers that are like a little shrub. Mm-hmm. And in different seasons, the shrub is like, you know, in winter it's covered in snow, and in spring it's got little blossoms, and in the summer it's, you know, I think that's a really cool sort of visual look, that it sort of changes with the seasons like that.
Yeah.
And that in the rutting season, or in the, you know, this part of the year, it just mm-hmm. looks horrifying.
Right.
I also want to maybe amend this meeting. I think I have a cooler idea for how this could go. So
okay.
maybe the grove was set on fire by like a rival like farmer or something, or like a land owner came in and was like, I want to buy this land from you, you got to get off of it. And the owner of the grove said, no, this is, my family's been here for thousands of years, like, we're not just going to give this up. And so they hire somebody to burn it down, and as the family is fleeing, maybe this child, their family dies in the blaze, and as they're escaping, they see on the edge of the grove this deer guardian caught in a trap, or, you know, caught up in like some, his antlers are caught in the trees or something. He helps free him, and then they have to kind of go on this quest for revenge together, sort of.
Cool.
And it's like the child is like innocent, like a child is, right? But mm-hmm. still kind of wants to make things right, and doesn't necessarily want to go kill people, but kind of wants answers, wants closure, right? But this great guardian beast is, you know, this ageless, eternal sort of force of balance. And the beast says, the appropriate thing to do is to go and kill these people. You know, we have to go and get revenge. And through this journey, the, you know, either the child's will or the monster's will would kind of win out. They would become more sympathetic or more evil. I like that there's two directions we can sort of go with that. And there is, of course, like goodness and kindness in this beast, but in this moment, the thing that it's meant to protect is completely destroyed. So its prime kind of directive is essentially to go and seek out revenge.
I like this a lot.
Yeah.
Do you see your deer monster, your guardian monster, does it like speak telepathically? Does it communicate at all?
I think it speaks telepathically.
Okay.
Like legendary Pokemon
style.
Yeah,
like Lugia.
Yeah.
The song.
Exactly. I think that's probably the way that makes the most sense. And I also think it's just freaky and weird in animated movies when like dogs and cats move their mouths.
Yeah, right.
When they talk. So I don't like it. It's unpleasant. So yeah, I think definitely it's a telepathic speaker.
Cool.
Certainly. So yeah, that's where I'm at right now with this. I think the next big steps for me are to kind of figure out maybe a little bit of detail about this child, who they are, and who the bandits are, or who the people are who came and burned down this grove. But let's pop over to you and get your prompt and see what you've got. Maybe these two creatures can kind of intersect in some way.
I'm not sure about that, because okay, so the word that I got was string.
Ooh.
And I was trying to think of kind of where I want to go with this, and my mind is kind of jumping over towards like the visual style of sort of like a Tim Burton, or I'm actually thinking kind of like the movie Nine.
Okay.
That weird CGI film about those little like
little
cloth
sock
people
puppets or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what I'm picturing, what I'm kind of picturing is, we didn't really talk about Frankenstein, idea of like,
monster.
Yeah, Frankenstein's monster, that like, this is something that was sort of created and then abandoned, and it's now here without a purpose, doesn't really know what it's supposed to do with itself. And so I like the idea that my creature, my monster, it looks sort of like, it's like, I want it to be really big. And I think it like, it can alternate between walking on two legs, but it also, I think, has these big, like kind of ape-like arms that it can go down and walk on four legs if it wants to.
Great way to make something look really unsettling is to have it walk on four legs and have it stand up, or vice versa.
Right.
Or whatever. It always is like, well, you're supposed to pick one. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly. So what I think this is that it's a creature that was essentially sewn together by like different pieces of like cloth and fabric, and it has all these like exposed seams of like string that was used to tie the different pieces together.
Sort of like Oogie Boogie style, kind of like a cloth golem kind of.
Yeah. I don't want to it like that, but
yeah.
I'm not crazy about Oogie Boogie myself.
Yeah, no,
like, so I don't want him to look like a big like pillowcase,
a big sack of shit.
Exactly.
Bugs and shit.
I feel like he needs to look like a hodgepodge of like things that were like sewn together. And I think I want it to look like it's sort of a patchwork creature.
Okay.
But definitely, I want it to be sort of like in this world where it just sort of woke up one day and it looks around itself and it's like in like the lab or the studio where it was. made, and maybe it finds like its creator is like lying dead on the floor, and it's like, I don't know what's happening, and I'm all alone.
Okay.
I think this thing, it doesn't have like a mouth. I don't think it can talk or communicate. It can like gesture and
its mouth is sewn shut.
Yeah. I'm definitely thinking like spooky. Coraline, like those kind of designs as well, okay. of these different, you know, like button-eyed things. And so I think it kind of just spends the beginning part of its life sort of wandering around like what's left of this weird place.
Cool. Trying to figure out who it is, why it is, where.
Yeah.
Where,
what. I'm actually sort of picturing it kind of like a giant sloth, like a giant land sloth. Okay. Like it has like these big like front arms
Did
with
you
like
say a
talons.
Land sloth?
Land sloth.
Oh, land sloth.
Isn't that what it was called? Those prehistoric sloths?
Yeah. No, the giant.
A giant sloth.
Yeah, a giant sloth.
Yeah. I think it kind of has like, it sort of looks like that. And I think there are, oh, you know what? How about this? This is not like an original idea at all. But what if in this world, there aren't many people left, but there are these kind of strange monsters, and the people who have survived whatever's happened are like used to fighting the monsters that they see.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe a lot of them do look sort of like my creature does. They also look like they're kind of made of things that are put together.
That could be an interesting sort of purpose for them, is maybe the creator created this creature in sort of their image because he was like, I want to make an ambassador to them or something.
Well, that's what
like
I'm
that.
Thinking. Yeah. Or maybe the creator like got a hold of one of these creatures and then tried to rewire it essentially to be like, I'm going to make you a good guy. But then something happened, like maybe like classic Frankenstein style. The people came in, they're like, you can't do this. And they killed him and stuff. Yeah. And the creature wakes up afterwards. So I feel like my creature, while it's out wandering around and encounters like this hunter, this guy who's survived by like killing these things. And at first he goes to like attack this our main monster character, but maybe like the monster like, you know, saves him, or it shows him something that says like, I'm good.
I mean,
and
it's recoiling sadly with puppy dog eyes.
I think, oh, you know what, here's a fun idea. Maybe the hunter is out looking for other members of his family, right? Because he's been separated from them, and maybe he's about to like, you know, deliver the killing blow to attack this beast.
Yeah.
But he notices that one of the pieces of like fabric that is like part of its skin is like, it's a cloak of his brothers or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Or a cloak of his sisters, and he's like, wait, where did you get
or
that?
It has his family's sigil on it or something.
Exactly. And and so then he's like, I have to work with you now, monster. Like, you have to take me back to where you came from so that we can figure out, like, maybe my sister is here or my family. And the beast is like, I don't really know, but sure, like, let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of going on a journey now to help them rebuild. Maybe their family or their tribe was like all kind of separated. And so it goes on this journey to help them reconnect and find each other again.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I have this really sad image in my mind that I really like of this idea of this, you know, patchwork monster, is that it would like unstitch a part of itself to like give the fabric to him, but when it does that, it starts to kind of deflate and fall apart.
Oh, no.
And like kind of die, and he's like, no, you keep this, like, well, until we can find a piece to replace it with. And
like
maybe that would be something that it does some great sacrifice in the end to like unstitch itself.
Winnie the Pooh style, he's running out of stuffing, right?
Yeah, exactly. He like all the sand starts spilling out and he's like, oh no, I'm deflating.
I also think so there could be an interesting, you know, you talk about tragic endings being generally like more interesting. I think something that might be kind of fun about this is not fun, it would be specifically not fun, you know, this hunter thinks, well, you have a piece of my family's sigil, you know, sewn into you. You must know something about them. You must be connected in some way. When the reality of it is the creator of this beast just grabbed whatever cloth he had lying around. Maybe there is no actual connection. And so this hunter is kind of thinking, you can help me find the answer to these questions. You must know where my family is. It must be trapped in your mind somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe at some point through some magical means, they meet a great wizard who can kind of restore this creature's memories, or it can, you know, show us what is like locked away somehow in its brain, and that just isn't there. It's just a coincidence.
Yeah.
And now they've done all of this traveling together and they've kind of developed this bond, but there is no sort of cathartic release. It's just sort of this hollow victory. And now they're like, I guess we're just friends, and they're just like sad friends together, like wandering the wastes.
Yeah. I feel like if this was like a movie, as I picture everything to be, when we have that scene where, you know, it's revealed, oh, I don't know, I don't have information about your sister. She's probably dead. This is just fabric that was sewn into my body, blah, blah, blah. And I think the hunter would have this big emotional reaction. He's like, get out of here. Like, I never want to see you again.
Yeah,
and he storms off or whatever.
I was only partnering with you because I thought you could help me. And then, you know, in his sadness realizes, no, I became partners with him because I care about him now.
Right. Yeah. There would be some scene where the monster is like off, like walking sadly by itself, and then other people come along and try to hurt it, but then the hunter shows up and he's like, no, that's my friend. Like, oh, I'm going to defend you.
He's like walking down an alleyway and a bunch of like bullies are like throwing beer bottle, like emptying beer on him, like throwing trash.
He's like, get out of here, you little urchins. Yeah. Don't mess with my sloth.
I like that. I love this connection that it's like a grown man and this great beast, the type of beast that he typically would hunt.
Yeah.
Is really cool because, you know, we don't often see in stories, I don't think we generally see adults go through the same kind of, this is the type of thing you would see like a child.
Right.
Would maybe start with sort of fear or biases and then they would grow to overcome those. It's not something we generally see in grown individuals. So mm-hmm. I like that as the connecting point.
Thanks.
I think that's much more interesting than having just like a little kid, because that's a story we see more commonly.
Yeah. Well, I'm such a sucker for the little kid monster story. Yeah, like, so I kind of wanted to go to that first, but I was like, we have a kid with your situation. So
certainly.
Maybe I should like certainly. Make an adult do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think other directions then that my story could kind of go, because I don't think they both should just be stories about people kind of wandering and mm-hmm. seeking revenge or trying to like, you know, control things. I think maybe part of my journey would be about finding a new home.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we assume that this is just like they overcome their desire for revenge through some adventure. And they realize, well, we don't really have a place in the world anymore. We have to find something we can do together. And we would see sort of a, you know, like in the Lion King, when Simba's like dancing across the log and he's like slowly growing into like teenage Simba and
yeah.
like adult Simba or whatever, there would be a little montage of them walking through the woods and this child growing up alongside this great elk.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, I like that.
He or she becomes like a powerful ranger, a powerful druid or something. And they're just like roaming around trying to find another grove to inhabit and become the new protectors of.
They're looking for the Great Valley.
Yes. Yeah. They're totally looking for the Great Valley. They're trying to eat all the tree stars.
Yeah. I gotta get some tree stars.
I like that a lot. So yeah, I want a little bit more hopeful of a story for this one then, since we're moving a little more into the sort of dire tragedy.
Nice.
With yours.
Yeah.
I want it to just be something where they say, no, revenge, we have to move past it, we have to let it go, it's tragic what happened, but that life is gone and we need to find a new one.
Question
for you.
That's
the journey they go on.
So your creature, it has all these like terrifying antlers spreading out of its head and its
yes.
back and everything.
Yes.
Because it's on this revenge quest, I can kind of see, like, how does it attack people? Does it simply, like, hurl its body against them? Or can it, like, make its, like, antlers grow and protrude, like, stabbing
yeah.
things?
I don't necessarily want its... I think the antlers on its back are kind of, like, vestigial. I think they're more just kind of, like, armor,
mm-hmm.
maybe, than that they can use them to actually physically attack.
Mm-hmm.
I would see it fighting in the way that a deer would, where it kind of, like, butts heads with things,
mm-hmm.
or it, like, swings its head around and smashes into stuff. That's definitely the way that I see it. But also, it's just huge.
Yeah.
And it can just kind of run over you
yeah.
if it needs to as well. It can just stomp you to death. If you've never seen videos of a deer attacking a person, even if they don't have antlers, even if it's, you know, like a young deer or, you know, like a female deer, or a deer that, you know, it's shed its antlers or something
mm-hmm.
like that. It's scary. I don't want to fight
Boom.
A deer. Well, they jump up on their hind legs and they bat at you with their hooves.
Oh, yeah. Very powerful kicks.
Yeah. They look very strong and it's very scary. I think there's a lot of things this guy could do to mess you up if it wanted to.
I feel like with my creature, apart from it being very big, I think it has like these like giant like sloth claws
cool.
on the front of it. And
cool.
it can use those for like big slashing. And like, I think it can also do sort of like when a gorilla like beats its chest and like slams its arms
oh, yeah.
down, it can do like these big boom, like intimidating like threats.
For sure.
I think it's important, yeah, with our monster characters to kind of talk about what makes them, like how would they fight and defend themselves
yeah.
and what do they look like when they're vicious.
Yeah, because, you know, like we said at the top, we said people are terrified of them because they look scary, but also they are powerful and scary. So
right.
we do need to fulfill that, you know, give them actual scary things that they can kind of do. I think these are both things that I wouldn't... If I saw a giant sloth stitched together out of, like, random pieces of fur and leather and cloth, like, I wouldn't mess with that.
No!
It looks big and strong, even if it's just full of, like, jelly beans or whatever is inside of it.
Full of jelly beans!
Yeah. I like where these are so far.
Should we throw in some modifiers?
Yeah, let's throw in some modifiers
yeah.
here. So let me go ahead and spin ye old wheel of modifiers here. And we don't really use this wheel that much anymore. I am liking
it's good
that
to go back.
We're getting back to it a little bit. Yeah. It was always fun to just throw a wrench in the gears here. So, Piper, I got the first prompt, mm-hmm. which means I'm going to give you the first modifier here.
Yay.
And the modifier that you have this week is, I'll never tell.
A big secret.
Yeah.
Ooh, you know, okay.
Big old secret. We kind of built a secret into it a little bit already in that there isn't a connection. It's just mm-hmm. like a mystery. So, you know, maybe you want to reverse that or?
No. Okay. So let me think. So I feel I have to first decide, do I want the big secret to belong to my cloth sloth, my sloth cloth, or do I want it to belong to my hunter guy?
Yes.
I feel like one thing that could be super sad and tragic is maybe because I think the creature doesn't really remember things from after it wakes up.
Yeah.
And it finds there are like all these spooky clues. It finds its creator like dead on the floor. Maybe its big secret that it's not intentionally keeping, it just doesn't remember this, is maybe it did kill him or her who created it. Maybe because I think the scientist, they, you know, they managed to subdue one of these great beasts and like drag it into their lab to kind of work on this rewiring of like trying to make it a good creature. And maybe like halfway through or partway through the, like the process, like it didn't have enough like sedative on it or something. And like our sloth, it woke up and it like lunged out at him.
Oh, it was just enraged because it was incomplete and it wasn't like ready to right. process all. Yeah,
exactly. And maybe it like slashed him to pieces. And so
interesting.
I guess that would be something though, that if the creature woke up and it would find its dead master, like the claw marks that killed it would, he'd probably maybe look at its big paw and be like, did I do this? Did I do that?
Perfect placement for a Steve Urkel quote there. Well done, Piper.
Oh my God, I love it.
I do like that. Like, maybe, you know, maybe the way that it like addresses that is maybe that's why it loses its memory, mm-hmm. right?
So, it represses it.
Yeah, he represses it. And he says, I can't allow myself to believe that I did this.
Right.
Like, I can't let myself be this horrifying monster. They built me to be better than that. And so it kind of blocks off that memory and it goes into sort of like a, almost like a coma, sort of like a fugue.
Yeah.
And it just goes on into the world kind of blindly wandering like that.
Yeah.
That seems like a very tragic
right.
story here.
Definitely. I like that a lot. I think maybe if we go with this idea that they go and find this wizard who can restore its memory, maybe that's another huge blow to the hunter, that he's like, it's revealed that the sloth killed its creator. And he's like, I thought you were friends with that guy. Are you bad? Can I trust you? Like, why did you keep this from me? And
I didn't know I was keeping it from me too.
And he's like, I repressed it. I didn't want it to happen. Like, it happened.
Yeah.
That's I woke cool. up and I made a funny Urkel joke. That's embarrassing, dude.
Yeah, exactly. If you had made a joke that bad immediately after killing your master, you would have probably tried to repress it too.
It's one of my favorite things I've said on this show.
Well, impossible to top that.
Oh my gosh.
I have a prompt for myself.
What is your prompt?
As well, I have got the prompt Battle Royale.
Nice.
Which means, in the past, the way we've done this is we've typically had us go head to head, have our creations go head to head and fight each other. I think maybe something that might be a little more interesting would be to have, well, I don't know. You tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be fun to talk about what it would be like for my duo and your duo to face off, or would it be more fun for you to say, maybe you like build a squad of monsters and then say we got a dragon and we got a giant snake and we got a bear. How many of these do you think
a gorilla?
A gorilla. How many of these do you think that my dear god can fight all at once?
Wait, what about this though?
What?
Since we're going with this whole like tragic story,
yes.
What if you have to describe a fight between your kid character and your dear character?
Oh.
What if they have to fight one another?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, because oftentimes in these stories, you're right. This is a better direction to go. Oftentimes in these types of stories, there is the like, I don't even love you anymore. I never loved you. Get out of here.
Get out of here, you dog.
Yeah. Like throwing a rock at you because you can't stick around here anymore. You gotta go.
Yell or leave.
They would get into some kind of argument about something, or you know, maybe the deer knows that in order to get to this new grove, they have to go through like a very dangerous area of the world, and they're concerned that if this child comes with them, they'll be killed. So they're kind of trying to convince this child not to come with him, and mm-hmm. they get into an argument that gets really heated, and the child is maybe offended, and they say, I've been with you since the day when we both lost everything and we've traveled together. You owe it to me to let me come with you. And it kind of escalates and turns into this like pretty nasty fight where they say, I can't take you with me and I'm not going to let you come with me. You have to go somewhere else. And it probably would kind of come to blows or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't mean for it to be a physical fight. Maybe the deer is trying to sort of brush them away, mm-hmm. and its strength is so great that it accidentally, maybe it like pierces the child in some way. And the child is just, it's like a flesh wound, but they're so just like shocked and upset by this that they run off into the woods kind of screaming and crying. And like, I feel so betrayed. Like my friend, my only friend, the only connection I have to my old life has now betrayed me. And maybe they are in this sort of this flight of mm-hmm. theirs. They're beset by bandits or thieves or wolves or something else dangerous in the forest. And now the forest god, the deer, has to come and save them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the reconnection. So yeah, a small little interaction, a tiny instance here, but I think that's kind of you have to have one of these
right.
in there, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of goes on to strengthen the relationship in the end.
I feel like another scene that I can see following that one,
yeah.
right? So like the they're having like a yelling match, the deer like swings its head a little too much, hurts the child runs off.
Yes.
And the child is now thinking like, I'm kind of afraid of you, how can I trust you, blah, blah, blah. I feel like a nice kind of narrative scene that might follow that is like, what if the kid like comes across like some hermit in the woods who like has this little house and he's got all these dogs
yeah.
and the guy is like helping the kid and he's like talking with them and he'll like the guy can like roll up his sleeve and be like, here's the time when my dog bit me, here's another time when my dog bit me, and here's another time when my dog bit me. And he's like, sometimes these things happen. They didn't do it because they were mad or they were evil or anything. Like we were playing too hard and he just like chomped or something. I feel like he has to like, someone needs to give him some perspective or a lesson to say accidents happen.
Yeah. Sometimes puppies bite.
Yeah.
It's not what they meant to do.
Exactly.
It's just what happens.
Sometimes deer gods swing their antlers too hard.
they whip their antlers back and forth way too hard.
They nay-nay.
They nay-nay. And it doesn't always work out for everybody. No, I like that. And so then they would go back and be like, I'm sorry. We have to do this together, though. Like, don't you understand? Like, we are bound together by blood.
Yeah.
Like, literally. It's, mm-hmm. it's got to be both of us together.
It'd be interesting. What if from the wound, like maybe like a little antler sprouts or something.
Oh,
like maybe like a way that like kind of binds them.
They're somehow touched by the forest magic in
yeah.
some way. Yeah. That's
so
interesting.
If they were like, let's say maybe they were wounded like by their elbow, maybe they get like cool little antler spike on their elbow
that's
they can use
cool.
to like cha
or
like
maybe,
jab somebody.
Maybe when they bleed, where their blood drips on the ground,
like
plants
something grows.
Grow or something
Ooh.
Like that. Yeah. So they now are like touched by their blood is magic somehow. They have, they've maybe ascended to the pinnacle of druidic or rangerly ability, that their blood literally can help grow and protect the forest.
Very
so
cool.
They kind of say, oh, I have to continue on this journey now. Like, I really am. There's no way that now that I have this gift, I can stop. I have
yeah.
to keep going forever and serving the nature.
You know what would be really interesting? What if there was like a significant amount of time that passes between their fight. Like,
oh, okay.
Because here's what I'm thinking. So maybe like the kid was injured
yeah.
and they go off and they don't see the guardian for several years. They grow
yeah.
up a little bit.
The guardian goes off and finds a grove or whatever. And
right.
is there now.
And yeah. the kid has this wound because you were talking about, the blood drips and things grow and that's how they know that things are fine. Maybe like they cut their finger one day, blood drips from their hand and like where it lands, like something dies and they know, oh my gosh, my guardian is in trouble.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because the magic comes from them.
Right.
So they're beset by evil magic or something somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. And that seeing that tells them, I have to go find my friend again because actually I care about them and I have all this time and I have to go see if they're safe.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. And so that it's now like a mad dash to try and find where did they end up. I'm using all of my magical tracking abilities to
right.
try and find them. And, I knew this was the direction they were going and they had to pass through this, across this terrible canyon and through this dark valley full of thorns. And on the other side is where we hoped that this place would be. And so they're, just praying that they get there in time to help their friend. And maybe they catch them like, maybe they find them just like when they first met, caught in a hunter's snare, and they'd had their antlers like sawn off or something like that.
Goodness.
They were like taken for, they were taken as like a prize, essentially.
Dang, I love that.
And so they find them and they have to, they're now sort of like weakened, and they have to kind of like rehabilitate and help them regain this magical power and help these antlers grow back. And
I love
like
that so much.
Yeah. So setting things back to zero a little bit, I think.
Yeah. There would have to be a scene like, we were just talking about this because we were watching Tarzan, where they come up and there would be like that moment where it's like in his mighty voice, "You came back."
Yeah.
He's like, "I came home." Exactly. Like, I'm here for you. Yeah. Oh,
that's really great. That's 100% where I want to leave this one.
Nice.
I think that's the best possible spot for it, where they're now on the same level, sort of, in a way. And they travel. They could never be separated again after this.
Yeah. Oh, I like that so much. Wonderful. Okay. Is your kid, what gender are they and what is their name?
I think I like the idea of it being, I like the idea of it being a young boy, because I think generally we see more of kind of like revenge being a, like a brutish, like masculine, like men kind of give into this like anger and this like rage more like typically in, mm-hmm. in stories like that. So I think that kind of makes sense because that's sort of the starting point for him.
Yeah.
I think his name should be, I sort of like the name, I think William is a very, it's a very kind of like European, like grim, like folklore type name.
Yeah.
It seems like your sort of basic, like boy who lives in the woods mm-hmm. kind of name to me. Yeah. So I think William and his great deer.
Nice.
William and the elk.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's very good.
What about you? Do you have a name for your hunter?
My hunter. Let's see. Okay. A name for a cool, grim hunter guy. I think Victor is a cool name.
Ooh, okay.
So maybe his name is Victor.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
That's very, like, kind of Transylvanian, like, Eastern European, like vampire hunter kind of thing.
Totally.
Yeah, like Van Helsing style.
Yeah, I'm definitely picturing the world that they're in. It's very kind of, like, grayscale, lots of ruined buildings.
That's what I was picturing, too, definitely. Yeah. Like, the road, sort of.
Exactly. I think my hunter guy, he's got, like, this, like, big sort of bloodborne like leather trench coat that
cool.
he wears.
I like it.
And he's got all of this hunting, like all these weapons on his back. So he's got his crossbow and his like spears and all kinds of different stuff.
And ropes and nets and
exactly.
Yeah, kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of how he looks. I feel like he needs to give like a silly name to his beast companion. Maybe it's simply just like Patches.
Patches makes sense.
Yeah.
I also, one other thing I think he should have is, so when Patches is injured, he has to be kind of like sewn back together, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Maybe this hunter, he just has a very, very small sewing kit for like mending holes in his trousers and things like that. And when he gets hurt, he's not really able to help him.
Yeah.
So this could be kind of an interesting thing is if he gets hurt, he's like, "I'll do my best, but like we really need to, it's very serious every time you get hurt. We need to get you to somebody who is more equipped to help you than
yeah.
I am, because I can only fix a little tiny hole. I can't fix a giant monster's arm falling off."
Right, exactly.
By sewing it on, yeah.
Well, that's another thing that I've kind of liked from the beginning that I haven't really expressed yet, but the image of, I feel like with its big like claws
yeah.
that kind of make me think of needles, I like the idea that it's tried to repair itself a couple of times.
Yeah, okay.
And so there's areas where you can see that the doctor did work, where it's like very fine stitching and yes. all of this nice stuff. But then there's also like real crude like patchwork that's been done. And like maybe it like got some duct tape or something and like tried to tape itself up. And so he's like, "Wow, you're really rough. Like,
for sure.
Did
for
your
sure.
helper just give up?" And it's like, "I did this myself."
I like that. Yeah, it's had to do sort of self-surgery, so it just has like horrifying scars from that, essentially.
Yeah,
all over its body, a body that's basically made of scars already,
right?
You know, but
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah,
I like that. Victor and
Patches.
Yes, and
I feel
William and the elk.
Yeah, I feel like the end of my story is actually where like maybe their movie could begin. Is that they're just this kind of strange traveling duo?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
someone would be like, "What is a monster hunter doing traveling with a monster?"
Whoa.
I know. And he's like, "Do you want our help or not?" Like,
that's cool.
Don't ask stupid questions.
I like framing it that way. What is a monster hunter doing with a monster,
yeah.
traveling with a monster?
Yeah.
That would totally be like kind of the tagline.
Totally.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and just put these down and walk away from them, I
yeah,
think, because
exactly.
these are in a good space. And it's time then for us at this juncture to pop on over into The Rec Room.
Da-da-da. Yeah,
the next segment of our show. And the recommendation that I have this week is actually for, there's a subreddit specifically for sympathetic monsters. It's called r/sympathetic monsters. And it's a really cool place where people share art of, there's a lot of, like personal art that people share from, they do web comics and things like that. There's also stuff where, you know, people from like DeviantArt or ArtStation or whatever share these big, beautiful paintings, but they're all of sympathetic monsters, obviously. Some of them are just really friendly, goofy looking dragons who are like hanging out with kids, like playing games and stuff. Some of them are like scary monsters that live under the bed and they're like, hey, can you turn on the nightlight? I'm kind of scared. Like some of them are really serious. Some of them are funny. Some of them are, you know, kind of walk the line in the middle. There's a lot of really, really great art on there from a lot of really great artists. So if you're looking for cool visual representations of some of these ideas, that could be a really great place to go. Any piece of art on there, you could totally make a character out of. And I think there is a bit of D&D crossover there. I was scrolling through the top posts from the last couple weeks here earlier, and there's definitely a lot of people talking about like little goblin commanders and you know, more D&D focused sort of creatures. So yeah, that could be a really, really fun place. Do you have any cool recommendations this week, Piper?
I do. You actually made me think of something that I hadn't really thought of ahead of time, but I'm very happy to recommend it. I have a very talented cousin who is an artist living in Berlin, and he goes by the name Matteo. And so you should all check out his website. It's yes. Matteo-art.com, and that's Matteo-art.com. And he specializes in doing monster paintings.
Yeah.
And all of his paintings are just the world's most adorable and relatable monsters.
They're all kind of like little scruffy little... dusty, dirty kind of guys too, a lot of them.
Exactly. Yeah. They all look like very dirty and silly, but they're very cute and approachable. I actually have one of his paintings, framed and hung in our apartment.
Yeah.
It's my favorite. It's this cute little dumpy guy. He kind of has a gonzo face and he's sitting at a little picnic table and he's got these crayons and he's drawing this like little kid's drawing of a monster. And it says on the drawing, it says me and a little smiley face. And he's just doing a little self portrait. And I'm like, aw, I relate with that monster.
It is nothing if not sympathetic, and it's extremely cute. We could maybe post a picture of you posing with that photo or
sure, yeah.
on Twitter here for anybody that wants to see it.
Yeah, but definitely check out my cousin Matt's art.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I can't believe I didn't think of that. Yeah, and he has a children's book,
he did just publish a children's book. I will have to look up. Oh, I think it's called Monsta. With like an A at the end.
Cool.
And it's about this little fuzzy monster who's about the size of a golf ball, and he has very big ambitions of being big and scary. And most of the pictures are like a little kid is asleep in bed and Monsta is there on the nightstand. He's like, wake up, I have to scare you. But he's like really tiny, and so it's not working.
Cute. Monsters, Inc.
Yes, that
How
too.
How did we not think of that? Yeah. Anyway, those are wonderful. We'll be sure to have links to all of that in the show notes, so it's easy for y'all to find. But yeah, some awesome recommendations. Simple, easy to find ones. Easy to consume, not like a go watch a 2-hour long movie or something this week. So
exactly.
Fun stuff. That then takes us on to the final stop on the World Forge Tour for this week. We're popping over to the Think Tank.
Exactly. Plug your nose and jump right in.
And I actually want to share, this time I'm taking the reins.
Ooh, take it away, Sam.
I'm going to share a little bit of a lovely email that was sent to us by a listener in Germany. That's Johannes Lova. They sent us an email basically just saying, hey, I really love your podcast. They found us through Josh from Arcane Forge. They were recommended by him when he came on and did our Dragons episode. They emailed and they said, dear Words, Smiths, I do not regret the day I followed Josh's recommendation to check out his feature episode on your podcast. I think it was Dragons, and I loved it. You quickly became my source of entertainment during work and filled the corridor of my mind with your imagination and creativity. The way you lay groundwork and explore your topic in other media makes it very accessible and promotes putting your own spin on it for a better understanding. I thought that was just... I don't know. That was so nice because
it's
that's
very nice.
Really exactly what we want to do.
Yay!
with
you.
The show. That's the thesis of all of this, is just to help... make world building and storytelling and creation of all kinds easier and more accessible, and to help you guys do it better, to give you guys kind of tools to do that.
Get better, guys.
Yeah, get better. Come on. I don't know. That just made us tremendously happy. We had a little kind of back and forth here, and they shared some really interesting stuff that they were working on for a world that they're building. They're doing this kind of 1920s occult, like they're doing like a Call of Cthulhu story where Nikola Tesla is involved in it, and there's this cult of people who are stopping these sort of like outside entities from coming in, and it sounds very, very interesting, and it may actually be something that we talk about in a future episode a little bit at length. They were looking for some advice, and I just thought the world that they had laid the foundation for already was really, really cool. So we might include a little feature on their world on something coming up. But
that would be awesome.
Yeah, it just was so much fun. We love when you guys share stuff with us like that. It's always really interesting for you guys to kind of pick our brains and ask for our advice. And we like to get to sort of go back and forth and talk about this. And that's just very, very fun for us. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Johannes, that was really, 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 really nice.
We're so glad that we can help inspire your creativity, because yes. Obviously, I don't think you need our help. It sounds like you've got an incredible imagination already. So the fact that you think that we are helping is very flattering. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to all of you listeners, obviously, for tuning in every week. If you want to find more of us or reach out to us, if you have something you want to email us, a fun world you're working on, or if you want to tweet at us, Piper, where can our listeners go to do that?
Well, if they want to talk to us on Twitter, we are at WorldForgePod on Twitter. And if they want to send us emails, like our good friend just did here, about all the creative stuff that you're working on so that we can praise you for your amazing ideas, you can send us an email at worldforgepod@gmail.com.
Absolutely.
There's also no better way to support our podcast than by writing us a nice review on any of the listening platforms that you use, because that absolutely really helps put us in front of more people so we can keep, you know, being inspired to do what we do.
Yeah, and it's totally free.
Yeah.
It's free for you, and it just makes our day every time. So that's
really nice.
That's always really, really fun for us to see. Every time I pop on Apple Podcasts and I see a 5-star review, I'm like, oh, someone not only listened, but they went to the effort to go and do that, which it really isn't a lot of effort. So
yeah,
we really, really encourage that. So
thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That is about all we have for this week, I think.
I want to say, next time you encounter a monster, maybe invite it out for coffee or tea. Get to know it. See if there's a story behind that scary facade.
Though you got
to
be careful, because Piper, if you give a monster a cookie,
He'll tell you his life story.
Yeah, that's how that goes. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Piper, and thank you, listeners. We'll talk to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.